This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
From 1988 to 1993, Danica McKellar showed up on ABC TV each week as Winnie Cooper on The Wonder Years. After the show left the air, she found a new passion, math.
So despite the fact that girls are scoring just as well or just as poorly in many cases as boys, that actually isn't the issue. The issue is they don't think of themselves as good, and so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from Danica about her fourth math book for girls. We'll also meet a young man who composed and published a crossword puzzle for the Sunday New York Times when he was only 17. And we'll spend an academic minute exploring an ancient Israeli mosaic floor. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. You may know Danica McKellar from her years as Winnie Cooper on the TV show The Wonder Years, but you may not know that she is an internationally recognized mathematician and advocate for math education. Her groundbreaking books on math have gotten rave reviews from students and teachers alike. She's back now with a new book called Girls Get Curves, Geometry Takes Shape. It was published this past summer. Her past three books include the classically titled Math Doesn't Suck and Kiss My Math. The actress and math genius shattered the math nerd stereotype by showing girls how to ace their math classes and feel cool while doing it. She spoke about the new book with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
So Girls Get Curves, I assume it was only a matter of time before you took on geometry.
Right, that's right. I'm following up the chain. So Math Doesn't Suck starts with, you know, basic math, and then we have pre-algebra, then algebra, and now geometry.
So let us go back of how you got started in this in the first place.
Wow. Well, I was a math major in college, and I also was invited to speak in front of Congress about the importance of women in math. And I learned when I was doing that the issues really start in middle school with girls when they start to lose confidence in themselves and they start to think of themselves as not being good at math, or that girls shouldn't be good at math, or if they're good at math, then that means that they're going to be nerdy or a social outcast. And that's a time of life where girls become, and boys become, more self-aware and more self-conscious, and they fall prey more to these stereotypes that are surrounding us all the time. And so I realized, you know what, that's what I want to target. That's who I really want to help and reach out to.
Let's talk a little bit about stereotypes and just about how to look at this. When we hear these very generic numbers given out about how poorly girls do in math and science, I've heard that that is, you know, that it's worse than even those numbers reflect. I've also heard that that is a stereotype and that there are many girls, many young women who excel and are far better than the numbers would reflect. How do you look at that situation?
The studies that I've seen from the last several years all indicate the same thing, which is that on average, girls are scoring just as well as boys. However, their confidence is much lower than boys. And so what happens is they end up dropping out of math as soon as they possibly can because they are afraid that they are not going to be able to handle it. And then they end up not pursuing math careers. They end up not pursuing degrees in math or science because they think they can't do it. And I've experienced this firsthand in many ways. Not only myself, when I got to college, I thought that college math would be so hard, I wasn't sure if I'd be able to handle it. I didn't think that I would be the kind of person who would be good at math in college. And I don't even know what that means now, because when I think about it, I had scored a 5 on the AP Calculus BC exam. So what did it mean for me to think that I wouldn't be good at math in college? Well, the truth is, I didn't look the part. And I was falling prey to the same stereotypes that I encounter when I talk to girls in my book signings who will tell me that they don't really get math. And I ask them what they're getting. Often they say, oh, A minus. And usually when I ask boys how they like math and how they're doing, they say they're doing just fine. And on average, oh, well, what are you getting? B plus. It's the perception. And that perception is so dangerous because we end up limiting ourselves. So despite the fact that girls are scoring just as well or just as poorly in many cases as boys, that actually isn't the issue. The issue is they don't think of themselves as good, and so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, I can't do this. Oh, I don't belong in math. Math's not for me. And when they hit a stumbling block, instead of seeing it as a temporary stumbling block, and we will all hit stumbling blocks in math because math is challenging, girls will tend to see the stumbling blocks as evidence of what they've known all along, which is that they don't belong in math.
Hmm. And is it true that, I mean, as a as a man who failed miserably in math, in a math challenge.
You may not have had a good teacher. It's very
well, you know, I don't know. I don't think I can blame all 17 math teachers, but I will say that it just seems to me that there's people who, you know, there's that right brain, left brain thing, right? Where there's some of us who are more interested in arts and literature, and there's other people who are more interested in math and science. Is that a fair generalization?
Oh, sure. I mean, obviously, in this world, different people have different strengths and weaknesses. And with my books, my main goal is not to create way more mathematicians and scientists out of girls than there normally would be. However, I do believe that with that kind of encouragement, I'm going to help find some of these girls that would, you know, just need that kind of encouragement, and then they will pursue those degrees. My main goal is to show girls that they can totally do this stuff. Maybe they like it, maybe they don't. But they can totally, they have, it's like, you know what, you got this, I got this, no problem. I don't like it, but I got it. And that's why I make math as, like, non-mathy, basically, as possible, because I do want to reach out to not only the girls who are enjoying math, but mostly to the girls who are frustrated, who think that they can't, that they're not going to be good at it, or that feel frustrated because maybe they don't understand what their teacher is saying in their classroom. I can provide other, way more fun kinds of explanations because I have the ability to do that in these books in a way that a lot of teachers don't have that type of luxury in the classroom. A lot of teachers are so pressed for time because they're teaching for the standardized test or for whatever other reasons that they're not able to do that, and I can provide this for students.
I remember the first time you were on our show for the first book, and your wish was that the first book would become part of a curriculum, that it would be used in schools, and that teachers would give it to students so that it would be, you know, that positive role model would be instilled in the classroom. Has that been the case?
Yes, and I get emails all the time from teachers saying that they keep the book in their classroom, that they use examples from it that do help to spice up their lesson plans, and of course I get so many emails from girls telling me that I've changed their life. I mean, it's really amazing. These teenage girls are so enthusiastic, especially like the 11-year-olds. They just use all these exclamation points, and they say, oh, OMG, you saved my life. And I'm finally getting A's, and I finally feel like I get this stuff, and I feel so much more confident. And some of my favorite emails are the girls that say, I finally feel good about being a smart girl. Because I am breaking that stereotype. I am telling girls, you know, you don't have to choose between being the fun, fabulous girl and being the smart, nerdy girl. Like, you can be any combination of those things that you want to be. That's why the math books don't look like math books. They look like teen magazines. And I'm breaking the stereotypes to say that if you're good at math, that you have to look a certain way. No, that's what I fell prey to when I went to college, thinking that I didn't look the part of a mathematician. You don't have to look like Einstein or like some, you know, typical, like, guy with pocket protector and a lab coat to be good at math. Math is the language of the world around us, and it behooves everyone to get better at math.
The name of the book is Girls Get Curves, Geometry Takes Shape. At the bottom of the book, it says, Inside Body Image Quiz. You would not expect a body image quiz to be in a book about geometry.
Well, in all of my books, not only do I teach math, but I also have tons of little self-esteem boosting tips throughout. You know, I've tackled stress relief and all different kinds of self-esteem issues, writing in a journal, how that can really help you to sort out your feelings. I have these throughout all my books. And this one, geometry, I thought, well, this is all about shapes. So why not tackle this huge issue for teenage girls, which is their body image and how they think of themselves. And comparing yourself to the airbrush magazines that are all around us and billboards and just an impossible standard of beauty that has been set that's not even real. So just helping girls navigate some of that.
As an actress, are you particularly sensitive to that?
As an actress, there's a lot expected of me in terms of being in shape and taking care of myself. And what I say in the book, you know, because you hear a lot out there about, well, whatever you are, whether you be, you know, you be 300 pounds and you're beautiful the way you are. Okay, well, that is true to some extent. However, if you're 300 pounds, depending on your height, of course, you are probably not taking care of yourself. Actually, I'm not sure that I can think of a height for which 300 pounds on a woman is healthy. but, you know, you want to take care of yourself. So there's that balance of you don't want to be obsessed. You don't want to, like, have to be super, super, super skinny like the models or whatever. But you also want to make sure that you're being healthy. Because if you eat right and you give yourself nice, moderate exercise, you're going to end up not being 300 pounds. You're going to actually be in better shape. And your mind works better, your body works better, everything works better when you take care of yourself. So take care of your mind by studying challenging things like math, and take care of your body. It goes hand in hand.
At what point did you get the confidence to go into the subject of saying, okay, I've had a successful career in acting, I've been on a wonderful program, and first of all, you come out of that relatively unscathed, you go to college and say, okay, I want to pursue math.
For me, I really needed to find out who I was outside of Winnie Cooper on The Wonder Years. I needed to know, like, who would I be if I didn't have that? Because after the show ended, I started feeling really insecure, like a lot of child actors do when their show ends. Like, wow, I was getting all this attention, and to be honest, I still got attention for being Winnie Cooper, and I still do. But when you start getting...
By the way.
And it's fine, and I'm grateful.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. But, you know, you begin to wonder, well, what, that's just a character. What else would I be? What if that never happened? You know, what if I never had that show? What would my value be? And so when I got to college and I did take that first math class, even though I thought I wasn't going to be able to handle it, and I did really well and I loved it, I thought, oh my gosh, I get it. I feel it. This, let me do this for a while. This makes me feel smart and confident and just strong young woman, and that has nothing to do with the glamour of Hollywood. So I felt at home, and I felt really great about myself. And the thing is, you don't have to have been on television to be struggling with who you are as a teenager. So when I started writing the books, I realized this is something I can really give to others. I can give this to girls and say, you know what, you can build yourself into a strong, confident young woman by tackling things like math. It's an amazing tool to use in that way. Doing math is like going to the gym for your brain. And to be honest, doing math is like going to the gym for your self-confidence, because the more you tackle things that you thought you couldn't do and then you succeed, you've taught yourself more and more that you are stronger and smarter than you thought, and that's going to extend to the rest of your life, that kind of confidence.
How old were you when you started The Wonder Years?
I was 12.
And you finished when you were?
18.
Yeah. So, I mean,
a couple months before I went to UCLA. I mean, the timing was really interesting because it was closing that one chapter in my life and opening a new one.
So your entire teen years are spent before a television camera, pretty much.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And, you know, I wonder sometimes if that has made me more qualified somehow to write these books, because I remember that time of my life so well. I lived it twice, once in real life and once on television.
Again, the name of Danica McKellar's book is Girls Get Curves, Geometry Takes Shape. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Still to come, who gets a crossword puzzle published in the New York Times when they're just 17? Well, we'll tell you who and meet them next on the best of our knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the best of our knowledge, number 1150. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The best of our knowledge is Ian Pickus, our colleague, is obsessed with crossword puzzles. Now, you may remember a little while back we ran an interview he did with Will Shortz, the crossword editor of the New York Times. He even composed his own crossword with a friend and submitted it to the Times. It was rejected for publication, but that did not affect his love of puzzles. Which brings us to an interview he did recently with Natan Last. Natan had a puzzle published in the Sunday New York Times when he was just 17. He interned with Will Shortz at the Times and has just put out a book of puzzles with Shortz called 144 Crossword Puzzles That Prove It's Hip to Be Square. Ian began his conversation with Natan Last asking how he got involved interning with Will Shortz.
This was after I'd published my Sunday crossword, and the editing process for that puzzle was really hands-on on his part. So we did a lot of back and forth. And I kind of just asked him if he had an opening. And he said that he would try me out and he really liked me. And we kind of just ran with it. It's an amazing opportunity to work with someone who eats, sleeps, and breathes crosswords. So it was a lot of fun.
And what kind of tasks does a Will Shortz intern have?
Well, some of my favorite tasks included, so Will does that puzzle show on NPR on Sundays, I think, and he tapes them on Fridays. And Friday morning, I'd get there, and he would test them out of me. And if I got them too quickly, he'd toughen them up. And if he needed help brainstorming some more answers, I'd also help there. My favorite part was actually dealing with the submissions. So, you know, when it comes to editing the New York Times crossword puzzle, it's basically a one-man operation. Will is sitting there in his office, and I would sit there with him, and we would comb through submissions. We would edit clues. You know, it was very fun for me to edit other people's submissions and suggest clue changes. Or I'm a bit of a grid freak, so if Will thought that a certain section of a puzzle needed work, I would, you know, get out pencil and paper and have at it.
Now, from what I understand, you know, a lot of people who write crosswords hate the cluing part. They like to come up with the answers. Is that true for you too?
It's interesting, yeah. I love cluing. People tend to fall in a couple different camps. So, you know, there's the thinking of the theme, the filling of the grid, and the cluing. And I'm lucky because I love all three, maybe for disparate reasons, but they're all great. And the cluing portion is where you really get to flex your wordplay muscle. And that's, you know, I love interesting, you know, clues with multiple meanings. I also love references. So cluing is where I get to, you know, pull from all corners of the pop culture market and just figure out what I want to talk about.
Well, as I mentioned, you had your first Sunday published when you're 17. How much time elapsed between when you first started solving the puzzle and you first had one in the paper?
About a year, I think. Maybe a little less. I went to Stuyvesant High School in New York, and during social studies class, we would pass out the New York Times. We had a free period, and, you know, a couple of friends would just crowd around and go at the New York Times crossword, and I was instantly hooked at you know, how funny themes could be, how inventive new fill could be, and how clever clues could be.
This book, Word, that you've put out, it's an updated 21st century, a lot of references, as you mentioned, group of puzzles. Now, Will has always talked about wanting to include the everyday language and that kind of thing, but did you have more freedom here than you think you would with several New York Times puzzles?
Definitely. You know, Will is an amazing editor because he definitely toes the line between, you know, wanting to push the envelope as much as possible, and because of his editorship, the Times has seen a bevy of awesome new themes that never would have happened without him. But you can't alienate, you know, the 90-year-old New Yorkers who get their New York Times and solve that puzzle with their coffee and stuff. You know, as much as I want to make every clue or answer a reference to Notorious B.I.G., it's just not okay. So in this book, we could basically do what we wanted. Everyone had published a puzzle in New York Times. They knew how to appeal to that audience, but here our audience was us. It was kids our age and people close in age, and we went wild. You know, I mean, the gold standard for this book was, has this answer appeared in any puzzle? Is this something that is fresh and new? And we threw it in there. You know, it was a really fun experience to push the envelope as far as we could.
How do you get rid of the famous, like, crosswordese answers that are in even the best puzzle has that aspect where, you know, you might see Brian Eno like 4 days a week as an answer?
The answer to that is just try, practice makes perfect kind of thing. With me, it's kind of a zero tolerance thing. I remember starting out solving, I just hated those answers, so I just do everything I can to avoid them. That means, you know, spending the extra day reworking a corner of the grid because you just can't have, like, Ibex or, you know, one of those words, you know, Olio, all those words that are just tired. So it's just a, you know, if you have to go back to the drawing board, you do it.
I imagine that Stuyvesant and Brown and a lot of your co-writers of the puzzles for this book are also Ivy Leaguers. I think the crossword is safe, but do you think that people will be doing crosswords in the New York Times or elsewhere? I mean, is it still cool with the average young person, no matter how many pop culture references you put in there?
Yeah, I mean, I really think it is. I think one thing that's cool is that crosswords are really well made to jump the gap technologically. So, you know, a friend and an awesome constructor, Ben Tossig, is coming out with an iPad app full of young constructors who have made puzzles for it. There's, you know, iPhone apps that you can solve crosswords on. if the prevalence of words with friends and, you know, all the Boggle variants means anything, then, you know, people still like playing word games. They just might do it in a new way.
You've interned with Will Shortz 3 times. Do you aspire to be the editor of the Times Puzzle?
I'm not sure. Having been at Will's house for, you know, a long period of time, he definitely has it good. He definitely is someone with the most playful job that you could possibly imagine, and he loves it. It's a bit time-consuming, and, you know, as with any kind of newspaperly endeavor, it's subject to the whims of other people's schedules occasionally. But I'm definitely considering it. I would probably make that decision very far down the line, but it's an awesome job.
You mentioned sometimes you're going to spend an extra day working on one clue just because you want to kind of avoid the tired language. How long does it take you to do a puzzle?
Right. It really depends. For the book, I you know, really got up there maybe a couple a day. For the New York Times puzzle, it can take anywhere from a week to a month if the theme is, you know, if it's a very intense theme and I'm like constantly workshopping the answers.
Again, the name of the new book is 144 Crossword Puzzles That Prove It's Hip to Be Square by Natan Last and Will Shortz. Natan spoke with the best of our knowledge's Ian Pickus. Okay, so we were talking about crossword puzzles, which kind of look like a mosaic, and recently there was an ancient mosaic floor unearthed in Israel. That may be the worst segue ever done on a national radio show, but it is the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. For archaeologists, every recovered object adds to our understanding of the past. Jody Magnus, the Kinnon Distinguished Professor for Teaching Excellence in Early Judaism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, reveals a recent find that could be a solid foundation for a deeper insight.
In June 2011, I began an excavation project in the ancient village of Hukok in Israel's lower eastern Galilee, assisted by David Amit and Shua Kiselevich of the Israel Antiquities Authority and sponsored by a consortium of universities in the United States and Canada. One of my goals was to locate and excavate a synagogue building, the remains of which were suggested by scattered architectural fragments visible on the surface of the ground. Last summer, June 2011, we discovered the synagogue's east wall, which is constructed of monumental stone blocks. This summer, June 2012, we reached the synagogue's floor and discovered that it was paved with stunning mosaics. One section of the mosaic, made of tiny stone cubes, depicts two female faces flanking a Hebrew or Aramaic inscription that refers to rewards for those who perform good deeds. Another section of the mosaic preserves part of a large male figure dressed in a Roman military-style tunic. To the left of this figure are pairs of foxes, each facing outwards, with their tails tied together and a lighted torch between them. This is a depiction of the episode related in Judges 15:4, in which Samson takes revenge on the Philistines by tying together the tails of 300 foxes and releasing them to burn the agricultural fields. Although figured mosaics are not unusual in synagogues of the late Roman and Byzantine periods, the 4th to 6th centuries of the Common Era, few of these buildings are decorated with biblical scenes, and only one or two others depict Samson. We plan to continue excavating at Hukok in summer 2013. At the end of this multi-year project, the mosaics either will be removed for permanent display in a museum in Israel, or they will be left in place and the site will become a national park.
That was Jody Magnus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.